It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Good morning. As huge numbers of foreclosed homes work their way through the real estate pipeline, another problem is blossoming: mold. When empty houses sit with all their utilities turned off, it can be the perfect environment for mold and potentially for thousands of dollars in damage. From member station WKSU in Kent, Ohio, Kabir Bhatia reports.
In most homes, as residents go in and out and the seasons change, natural ventilation sucks moisture up to the attic and out through the roof. It's called the stack effect, and in many parts of the country, it's driven by air conditioning in the summer and heat in the winter. But no one is going in or out of most foreclosed homes, regardless of climate, and the effects can be devastating. In some states, it's estimated that more than half of foreclosed homes have mold and mildew issues. Realtors across the country say they're seeing the problem in everything from bungalows to McMansions.
This is a nice house, you know? It's kind of artsy-fartsy.
Bob Bennett runs Farsight Management in northeastern Ohio, which specializes in cleaning up water-damaged buildings. A full quarter of his work now comes from moldy, foreclosed homes where the electricity's been shut off. No electricity means no sump pump or dehumidifier for months or even years, and that often means mold. Slimy black or green patches creeping up drywall chest high and blanketing bathroom fixtures.
Now here, water came out of the sump and it got underneath the carpet, came over to the wall, and then wicked up the side of the gypsum board. And so you can see this banding where the top of the wicking stopped. And do you see the growth on the paneling? Is that gross or what?
Even minor mold abatement can start at $5,000 and cost much, much more. In this particular case, Bennett estimates more than $6,000, plus the cost of new floors, walls, and carpet. He wears a head-to-toe protective suit on most jobs. Realtor Rebecca Terakitis shows an increasing number of abandoned, foreclosed, and moldy but otherwise fine homes to prospective buyers.
I have a release form that I use, and if the property's got a lot of mold in it, I don't even let my own husband go in without signing those disclosures because I don't want the liability.
I had one really interesting. It was the middle of winter. There were icicles coming out of the windows above the garage. No heat, but it was 80 degrees inside of the house because it was self-composting.
Realtors say they don't think banks mean to incur thousands of dollars in mold damage just to save on monthly utility bills. But the mold problem appears largely to be a manifestation of the foreclosure crisis. Bills go unpaid, houses sit vacant, and the whole process takes much longer than anyone wants. Ohio Bankers League President Mike Van Buskirk says by the time the banks process foreclosure paperwork, it's often too late.
There are a lot of government, you know, steps in the courts and the county sheriff and stuff that are involved in it. And while it varies across the state, some of them, thinking that they're helping the consumers, are really dragging out the process so that it can take 2 or 3 years.
Realtor Jill Flagg says many lenders won't even sell a home for less than the mortgage note. So the house sits and sits, and it continues to grow mold.
I had an offer on a house with Bank of America where they have agreed to do a short sale, and it's been over 2 months and they have not even responded to the offer. They don't have enough staff to move it along, too backed up. They don't have qualified people that know what they're doing. It's, you know, it's in a pile somewhere.
Charges of faulty paperwork have slowed the pace of foreclosures in recent months, and that may be exacerbating the mold problem as those houses sit and bake through the long, hot summer. For NPR News, I'm Kabir Bhatia.
The Department of Veterans Affairs tries to make it easier for vets to buy houses by guaranteeing loans. Nowadays, there's a huge number of foreclosed homes on the market, and in many areas, those homes are the best deals. But VA loans come with lots of rules and requirements, and vets trying to use them are running into big problems. NPR's Yuki Noguchi explains.
It's in pretty much everyone's interest that someone buy up foreclosed homes. It's good for neighborhoods, it's good for banks. The economy benefits, and the buyer gets a home to live in. But buying a foreclosed home or one in short sale can be difficult, especially if you're a veteran and want to use a VA loan. Take Eric Warner. A third of the homes he looked at in Palmer, Alaska, were foreclosures.
But there was no point in even looking at it because they'd tell us up front, no VA loans.
The VA and Federal Housing Administration have long offered loans designed to help veterans and middle-class buyers. The VA guarantees up to 25% of a loan, which makes it possible for buyers like Warner to put no money down. The subprime crisis gave no down payment loans a bad name. Now more vets are drawn to the VA because they offer the best deal in the market. But the VA loans require that houses must be in great condition, no repairs. In today's market, with so many foreclosures, this caveat often turns out to be a deal breaker. Eric Warner.
There's very few times that I felt embarrassed for being a veteran, but finding that in many ways it was becoming a stumbling block to securing a good home for my family was sort of shocking and embarrassing.
You might think that a bank with lots of foreclosed homes to unload might be eager for deals. But even in areas where foreclosures make up the bulk of what's on the market, realtors told me clients had trouble trying to buy distressed homes. One woman in St. Louis says her family may abandon the VA loan option because the restrictions are just too frustrating. After 5 months, Warner finally did buy a house. Did you ever consider giving up on the VA loan?
Frequently. Usually at about 1 o'clock in the morning after, 1 or 2 hours of my wife crying and saying, why is it this hard?
The irony is the VA says it created its requirements to help vets. The appraisal is the VA's way of protecting vets from sinking money into a rundown house they later might not be able to afford. Of course, normally, foreclosures are relatively rare. Today, the market is flooded with them.
We have talked among ourselves about, well, are we protecting somebody out of the home?
This is Bill White, Assistant Director of Loan Policy for the VA. White acknowledges the VA has gotten complaints about the rules, but he says the VA has no intention of changing its requirements. Emily Winslow isn't sure what to blame for having to endure 6 months of bank applications, inspections, and paperwork. During those 6 months, Winslow moved her family 5 times, from a hotel to friend's house, back to another hotel. Then, at 9 months pregnant, still waiting, she frantically searched for a rental.
And no one could accommodate us because our stipulations were so challenging. Here we were just waiting on the deal. And, you know, we have a month, maybe two, until this deal goes through. I'm having a baby in 2 weeks. Can you please help us out? And they said, no, I'm sorry, I can't.
The rental finally came through, but their offer remained in limbo. The house they wanted didn't pass the VA's inspection because of a termite problem.
We were just so brokenhearted a number of times because it appeared that the whole deal was going to fall through.
In January, Winslow's family bought a house in Augusta, Georgia. She still feels embittered by the process.
If common sense were used, we wouldn't have had to go through this. You know, maybe a wife is out there whose husband is deployed and she's going through this by herself and doesn't know what to do. My heart breaks for people like that.
Winslow says there's good intent behind the VA's rules, but she doesn't understand how there could be so many homes out there needing families when so many families need homes. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Something about the American story is not going according to script right now, in particular, the American economic story.
We think of ourselves as a country of innovators and risk takers. Many fail, but some succeed. That's one reason our economy is constantly changing and churning, even in this period of slow growth.
One question right now is whether American businesses are innovating enough to create new jobs. And that's our next subject as we look this week at the economy's new normal. NPR's Wendy Kaufman looks at the current state of innovation.
Tom Clement is just the sort of entrepreneur the U.S. needs to propel the economy. He loves brainstorming and developing new ideas and turning them into products and companies. Back in the mid-1980s, as he was leaving to climb Mount Everest, his friends asked if he was frightened. No, he said, just excited. Today, he says, starting a new business is a lot like scaling mountains.
It's that same sense of just being out there, putting yourself out there. You know, that part of you that wants to take a risk, that enjoys that feeling of uncertainty and needing to figure things out as you go.
Over the past 30 years, he started or helped to start a number of companies in the medical device field. Today, we're at the suburban Seattle offices of Pathway Medical Technologies. It makes a specialized tool that physicians use to clear clogged arteries in the leg.
These are Swiss screw machines, and they're about 30 feet long. So, they wouldn't fit in most people's living rooms. And yet the parts that are coming off of them can be a tenth of an inch in diameter.
This sophisticated and innovative technology has created jobs. 6 years ago, Pathway had 20 employees. Today, there are 200. And company co-founder Clement isn't sitting idly by. A few miles from here, he started two new companies and is already offering some people jobs.
Hi, Margaret. How are you?
Hello.
Thanks for coming in.
But as the 55-year-old entrepreneur knows all too well, turning good ideas into new products and companies isn't easy. Still, it's something the U.S. has to do to keep the economy growing. Economist Ken Goldstein of the Conference Board explains that for the first part of the year, the U.S. economy grew very slowly, at an annual rate of just under 2%.
Without innovation, not only are we stuck at 2%, we might be lucky to get 2% growth.
Goldstein says a concerted focus on innovation could boost growth by perhaps 0.5%.
That's got to be worth alone 50, 75, maybe even 100,000 jobs a month.
Nothing to sneeze at when you consider that just 18,000 jobs were created last month. But innovation and the jobs it creates doesn't happen overnight. It takes time. And there's another stumbling block, money. Again, Ken Goldstein.
Where we are right now is not a dearth of ideas, but the ability to finance those new ideas into new companies, into new products, into new services hasn't broken down, but it has slowed down.
Right now, there's not much public money being invested in innovation, and despite historically low interest rates, there's not all that much private sector investment either. Rosabeth Moss-Cantor of the Harvard Business School suggests that investors and companies remain skittish about the U.S. economy.
Companies, for example, claim they want innovation. I sometimes talk to them and they say, we want more innovation, just not that idea, not that idea, not that idea. To have high levels of innovation, you need more people trying more things, even if they fail.
Risk-taking and tolerance for failure have long been hallmarks of American business culture, and they've played a role in making the U.S. the most entrepreneurial country in the world. But entrepreneurs elsewhere are beginning to take more risks. And, says Cantor,
we used to attract the best and the brightest. People from other countries would come here to start businesses, discover new things, create jobs, and now that talent might go back to their home countries because they see those countries as full of opportunity.
Other countries are indeed gaining ground on the U.S. in innovation-related indicators, things like patent awards and research and development spending. China, for example, is now a leader in clean energy. But confidence here at home remains a huge problem. Innovation has a chicken-and-egg quality about it. You need innovation to spur the economy, but you need confidence in the economy to drive innovation. Harvard's Rosabeth Cantor puts it this way. Innovation will be stifled if a country is scared, afraid to invest, and uncertain. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly, in for Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We don't really know if we're any closer to a deal that raises the federal debt limit. In public, the rhetoric is getting stronger.
Lawmakers are also having heated discussions in private. After House Republicans met yesterday, one senior lawmaker told the National Review, quote, only one word comes to mind right now, chaos.
NPR's Scott Horsley reports on the maneuvering as the time to make a deal is growing shorter.
Lawmakers now have less than 3 weeks to extend the government's borrowing authority, which runs out August 2nd. Otherwise, as President Obama told CBS News, Social Security recipients may not get the money they're expecting the very next day.
I cannot guarantee that those checks go out on August 3rd if we haven't resolved this issue, because there may simply not be the money in the coffers to do it.
Despite that dire warning, the administration says it's confident the debt ceiling will be raised. But the path to get there is far from clear. Republican lawmakers had been demanding big cuts in the federal budget deficit. Longtime political observer Norman Ornstein of the conservative American Enterprise Institute says President Obama effectively called their bet, offering to shave trillions from the deficit through a combination of spending cuts and increased tax revenue.
The president stepped in with something that took Republicans aback by pushing for a much more ambitious plan and giving them a lot of things that they'd asked for, but demanding something that they didn't want to give up. And they now look like the recalcitrants. So Republicans in both houses are trying desperately to find a way to shift the blame.
Republican House Speaker John Boehner had been negotiating privately with the president until last Saturday. He backed out when rank-and-file Republicans rejected the idea of any increased tax revenue. Yesterday, Boehner suggested it's up to the president to make the next move.
This debt limit increase is his problem, and I think it's time for him to lead by putting his plan on the table, something that the Congress can pass.
President Obama argues it's unfair to cut government programs that help the poor and middle class without also asking wealthy Americans to pay more in taxes, beginning in 2013. White House spokesman Jay Carney says Republicans and Democrats need to work together.
If we were to default on our obligations, who suffers? Democrats, Republicans, or Americans? Americans suffer. The American economy suffers. The global economy suffers.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell offered little hope for a bipartisan breakthrough. He said on the Senate floor yesterday, as long as this president is in the Oval Office, a real solution is probably unattainable. Instead, McConnell proposed what he called a backup plan that would allow the government to keep paying its bills.
What we're not going to be a party to in the Senate, I'm pretty confident, is default.
McConnell's proposal would allow the president to raise the debt ceiling on his own in three installments over the next year and a half. Lawmakers could vote against the increases, but would only be able to block them with a two-thirds vote. Mr. Obama would also be required to propose spending cuts in amounts equal to the new debt, but Congress would not be required to actually make those cuts. Political analyst Ornstein criticized McConnell's proposal. It would not limit the government's debt, only lawmakers' apparent responsibility for it.
I suspect what McConnell's trying to do is to say you can only do this via spending cuts and we will wash our hands of those and then we'll blame you. If that's a formula for saying we're responsible to govern and you should put us in charge of all three branches, I don't think it's a very persuasive one.
Still, the White House left the door open to something like McConnell's proposal to preserve the government's borrowing authority should deficit talks break down. The administration's push for a supersized deficit-cutting package got some support yesterday from the business community. Major companies and business groups wrote to lawmakers and the president, urging a substantial effort to reduce the deficit, even if it requires tough choices. Ornstein says while the White House is playing to independent voters who want a compromise, congressional Republicans are listening to elements within their base who don't.
I'm not at all sanguine that we're going to rescue this at the 11th hour. It may be at the 13th hour, but by then a whole lot of damage will have been done.
Another round of talks is scheduled later today. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.